Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, June 11, 2024. President Salva Kiir calls for peace and unity.
I want to assure you that your government is working hard to consolidate peace and national unity through sports.
And the International Criminal Court says the situation in Darfur needs urgent attention.
The evidence my office has collected to date seems to show credible, repeated, expanding, continuous allegations of attacks against the civilian population. In particular, attacks directed against camps for internally displaced persons.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The International Criminal Court's Chief Prosecutor, Karim Khan, appealed Tuesday for information and evidence of atrocities committed in Sudan's western Darfur region. He says his ongoing investigation seems to disclose an organized, systemic, and profound attack on humanity.
The evidence my office has collected to date seems to show credible, repeated, expanding, continuous allegations of attacks against the civilian population. In particular, attacks directed against camps for internally displaced persons. It seems to show the widespread prevalent use of rape and other forms of sexual violence. It seems to disclose consistently the shelling of civilian areas, the looting of properties, and attacks against hospitals.
Darfur has been one of the epicenters of the ongoing conflict between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces that broke out in April last year. The U.S. government and rights organizations have raised the alarm about reports of rights abuses against civilians from non-Arab communities, including ethnic cleansing, allegedly committed by the rapid support forces. Sudan's army has also been implicated in reports of indiscriminate aerial bombardment that killed civilians in Darfur and the capital Khartoum. The ICC chief prosecutor was speaking at The Hague earlier today, where he urged the public to help document and preserve evidence of attacks against civilians in Darfur.
In support of our investigation into these crimes, we are calling in particular for any video, photographic or audio material that those on the ground have been able to capture. We are asking civil society and all partners, all individuals, all of you watching, to provide any contacts that you have with those who may be able to provide testimony, information or evidence to advance our investigations.
For more insight, my colleague Nabil Biagio reached David Crane, who was the founding prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, which indicted former Liberian President Charles Taylor of war crimes. Crane remains involved in efforts to achieve justice in conflict zones, including Sudan's Darfur. He began by drawing a distinction between atrocities he persecuted in Sierra Leone 2 decades ago and the situation unfolding in Darfur.
Atrocities are atrocities, and they're not the same anywhere in the world. So I would be very careful in comparing the tragedy in West Africa, particularly Sierra Leone, to the Darfur situation. But however, it is important that we do see justice for victims of atrocity.
The ICC's chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, has highlighted systemic attacks on civilians in Darfur. Based on your experience, what are the critical steps the international community should take to effectively investigate and prosecute these crimes?
Well, support the International Criminal Court in its leadership in seeking justice for the victims of Darfur. That is critical. To also publicly voice their support for the International Criminal Court in their efforts in investigating the tragedy that is in Darfur. and also certainly assist materially in doing that as well. And it's very incumbent upon the government of Sudan to cease and desist whatever policies they have in Darfur, because they are potentially culpable as well, to include the leadership for, in fact, perpetrating the tragedy that is Darfur. So the government of Sudan has an obligation to assist Karim Khan and his important efforts in looking at Darfur and perhaps seeking justice for them.
It's a bit of a tricky situation, since they might be implicated themselves, as you just mentioned. And back in your day when you were prosecuting atrocities committed in Sierra Leone in the early 2000s, I imagine evidence gathering was not as easy. Today, with citizen journalism, social media, smartphones, a situation has been made a lot easier and evidence is more accessible. What challenges does the ICC face today in collecting evidence and securing cooperation from local and international actors in conflict zones like Darfur?
Well, that's a good question. Ironically, it's actually getting harder to gather evidence today than it was back when I was gathering evidence the old-fashioned way, back in West Africa between 2002 and 2005. There is so much data, and it's just pure data, that is out there on social media and elsewhere, that it's like looking for presentable evidence in court. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. So, in fact, all of the data that is out there throughout the internet, websites, and social media, most of that data, almost 99% of it, is not presentable in a court of law to prove your case of atrocity against the people of Darfur. So ironically, it is actually harder now to find that specific evidence, because the rules of procedure and evidence haven't changed, even though the technology has changed. We still have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element of an atrocity crime before a proper court, such as the International Criminal Court. And they have their rules of evidence that require that we ensure that the evidence is relevant and that the foundation is laid so that it is the proper evidence that's being offered to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Ironic indeed. And Sudan's civilian population, caught in the middle of this conflict, is facing a double humanitarian crisis, displacement and hunger. We have over 10 million people displaced today and a looming famine, as aid agencies have been reporting. What role can international legal institutions play in ensuring that humanitarian aid reaches those in need, and how can they help prevent future atrocities?
Well, again, the international community has to understand that atrocities don't go away on their own, and that if they ignore them, they just fester and create more pain and suffering, and in reality also perpetrate potential further atrocities in the near term and in the future related to revenge and those kind of things. So the international community has to take the political steps, and really the bright red thread of successful atrocity investigations and prosecutions is a political decision. In other words, it'll be a political decision by the United Nations, by the Security Council, by the General Assembly. Other nations such as the European Union, the African Union, make a political decision that something must be done in the Sudan, and a political decision made to help investigate these atrocities that are being started by the International Criminal Court. So all of these international organizations have an obligation to assist and to help stop the perpetration of atrocity in the Darfur region.
That's David Crane, the founding prosecutor of the Special Courts for Sierra Leone from 2002 until 2005. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from Maggie Valley in the U.S. state of North Carolina. Soccer fans, or fans of football, are back at the Juba National Stadium after the facility was shut down for 3 years. President Salva Kiir used the stadium's inauguration today to call for peace and unity among South Sudanese. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Thousands of soccer fans filled Juba National Stadium today to support President Kiir as he opened the stadium and shared a message of peace.
I want to assure you that your government is working hard to consolidate peace and national unity through sports because of our people's talent and love for sports. It is my government's policy to continue investing in sports and I invite the private sector to join us in this struggle.
The reconstruction of the stadium was fully funded by the Federation of International Football Association, or FIFA. Augustine Madut is the president of the South Sudan Football Association.
The Juba National Stadium is not just a venue for matches. It is a sacred ground where aspirations are nurtured, talents are honed, and dreams are realized. It is a symbol of our collective passion for football, our unity as a nation, and our quest for excellence both on and off pitch.
FIFA President Gianni Infantino, who attended the opening ceremony, says today carries a message of hope for South Sudan.
Today, the eyes of the world are on South Sudan. Today, in South Sudan, in Juba, we are opening this beautiful, beautiful stadium. Today, with the stadium, we are giving a message of hope to all the people of South Sudan. Today, with football, we unite the world, we unite South Sudan, we unite Africa, we unite all the people who love our game, all the people who love football, all the people who love peace, all the people who love unity. And we do this here in your capital, in Juba.
The country's national soccer team, the Bright Stars, played against neighboring Sudan in the fight for the 2026 World Cup qualification. Agnes Nyanajur, a South Sudanese soccer fan, could not conceal her joy.
I'm so excited to be here today because it's South Sudan versus Sudan, and I'm supporting South Sudan. I'm so excited Sudanese has to win as well. And I also appreciate FIFA and the president of South Sudan Football Association.
South Sudanese soccer fan Choliai says he missed watching games at the stadium and is excited to be taking part in this match.
This is the first official game between Sudan and South Sudan, but I'm so excited and optimistic that we're going to win this match. You know, it's very good for South Sudanese people to, like, we have been missing this moment. I cannot describe this in words, you know, being a first time to sing a national anthem in this beautiful stadium.
Eldin Zakaria, a Sudanese national living in Juba, says soccer can bring joy back into his life.
Although we are in two different nations, we are one people, and I hope that this match will end in draw to show our love for one another. Also, I hope that this match will touch the hearts of the fighting force to celebrate and think about their people.
Zakaria says the conflict in Sudan has crippled the sports industry in his country. At the end, Sudan beat South Sudan by 3-0. South Sudan faced Democratic Republic of Congo in their next match as they strive to qualify for the 2026 World Cup. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
From Juba, we head to Torit, where the legislators at the Eastern Equatorial State Assembly are complaining because the House has not been having its sittings for the last 6 months because of building renovations. The closure has affected the ability of legislators to get reports from executive, approve the state budget, and discuss urgent issues. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
Visa Likali Olum is a member of the Eastern Equatorial State Legislative Assembly. He says their role is to see the government implement planned activities and accounts for them. But the closure of the parliament building for repairs makes that difficult. He says with a new fiscal year coming, it is urgent that the state assembly be opened.
This is already June. We are entering now to a new budget in July. Always budgets are done in July for another fiscal year. So July 2024 to 2025. This is what we are now. If the parliament is to open soon, that is the budget we are looking after. The other one is already a dead case. And we cannot say maybe parliamentarian are the problem. But we are saying that that has come in due to the gap of the parliament not functioning. It is a little bit quite difficult to say it now, how government is functioning really without the budget.
Onen Charles is a civil society activist in Torit. He says parliament has not served its citizen as mandated.
I believe if for 6 months the parliament is not open and the parliament is not working, I think the parliament is not doing their roles as required. Because by constitution of this country and also by the state constitution, the parliament should not go for all these months without being functioned. It means they are not doing their role as required.
Charles Odua Okech is the speaker of the Eastern Equatorial Legislative Assembly in Torit. He says the contractor doing the renovation work in the parliament building has delayed and the work is still not done.
We have decided to open the parliament with the current situation as it is, because we cannot wait for long. People are waiting from us. Citizens of Eastern Equatoria are waiting from us to also raise their concerns. So as ABC, we decided that we have to open the parliament the way it is. So I had a meeting with His Excellency the Governor. We shared this, and we are soon to schedule the date for opening.
The speaker says he apologizes to the citizens of the state and has promised to open the parliament soon. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Torit, Eastern Equatorial State.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what is the relationship between the police and journalists? Stay tuned for an answer after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Uncertainty about South Africa's future is causing the country's currency and shares in its companies to lose value as political parties negotiate to form a government. The African National Congress lost its majority after a recent election and needs support from opposition parties to establish a new administration. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
The African National Congress, or ANC, proposes that all 10 parties in parliament, ranging from far-right to hard-left organizations, form a government of national unity. But uniting groups with vastly different philosophies is proving difficult. Mesh Pillay is a financial expert whose firm gives advice about investing in the continent's most industrialized economy.
We're talking to some of the sovereign funds out of the Middle East, the pension funds in South Africa and globally, and then the high net worth and family offices globally. I think they all want the same thing. They want a stable government. And that's the challenge right now, is we don't know where we're going to go over the next few days.
South Africa's second biggest party, the centrist Democratic Alliance, the DA, is built around conservative capitalist policies geared toward allowing the private sector to flourish. The DA stands in contrast to the other major opposition parties the ANC has invited to help it govern. The economic freedom fighters, the EFF, and Umkhonto we Sizwe, MK, want the state and not private companies and individuals to control wealth, including mines, land, and banks. They say profits from these assets should be given to the millions of poor people in South Africa. Pillay says international business people are more at ease with the DA's economic policies than they are with MK and EFF's philosophies.
They want a government that's market friendly. They want a government that fights corruption. They want a government that upholds the legal frameworks in this country, as well as the financial frameworks and businesses in this country. And if we can get that, I think the international community will be very comfortable with putting further capital in the country. But at the moment, the reality is there's a lot of capital waiting on the sidelines, watching South Africa very closely and determining whether or not this is the right investment to make.
South Africa is a major exporter of gold, coal, diamonds, agricultural products, and automobiles. Several large international banks, mining companies, and others base their African operations in the country. Since the election on May 29, the rand has slipped to about 18.8 to the US dollar, from around 18.1 before the vote. Today, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange All Shares Index began trading down nearly 1%, dipping below 76,000 points. It's down almost 5% from its peak this year at just over 80,000 points on May 20. Some international financial agencies say South Africa's ability to borrow could be harmed should MK and the EFF join the government. They say investors won't put money into a country where the state might seize their property. Fitch Ratings, for example, says the country's debt burden is likely to increase. Economic growth will weaken and governance could erode if the ANC signs an agreement with those parties. African politics expert at the University of London, Adam Habib, says the success of the new government depends largely on the DA.
There are huge challenges with the DA. I don't think it's been responsive to the interests of the black middle classes, and it isn't very nuanced on the racialized politics of our history. Having said that, it is the most appropriate partner for growth, stability, poverty alleviation, and jobs.
The parties involved in coalition talks haven't got much time to argue. Markets are losing money and Parliament opens Friday. Lawmakers are supposed to elect a president, setting the Rainbow Nation on a fresh journey, with destination unknown. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
From Johannesburg, we move to the United States, where U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump is back on the campaign trail following his convictions in New York for falsifying business records. At rallies in the western United States, Trump focused on immigration and threatened to sanction countries, including China, if they do not stop people from leaving for the United States. VOA correspondent Scott Stans has our story.
Donald Trump returned to the presidential campaign trail last week in Arizona, where he said President Joe Biden has lost control of the U.S.-Mexican border.
It's all unsustainable. But the Biden invasion is no accident. It's a deliberate demolition of our sovereignty and of our borders. Somehow, somebody's going to explain to us why they would want this to happen. I guess it's probably votes.
There is no evidence that non-citizens are voting in significant numbers in U.S. elections. Trump was asked how he'll stop illegal migration and said he'll act against foreign governments that feed it.
If China or some other country is behaving badly, we have things called tariffs that are so severe.
The Biden administration this month moved to block asylum claims at the Mexican border when arrests for illegal crossings exceed 2,500 a day. Biden says necessary immigration reform need not come with the inflammatory remarks that Trump directs toward migrants.
While we fight for comprehensive immigration reform, he calls immigrants rapists and murderers. He says they are not people. They are not people. He says immigrants are, quote, poisoning the blood of our country. Folks, my predecessor wants a country just for some of us. We want a country for all of us.
Biden says Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric is out of line with founding American principles.
You represent how we are as a nation of immigrants, nation of dreamers, nation of freedom. And that's the America we share.
Trump's rallies last week were his first since being convicted of falsifying business records to hide so-called hush money payments he made ahead of the 2016 election. He told a rally in Nevada that his trial was the result of Biden weaponizing the judicial system while failing at the border.
This is the worst border in the history of the world. There's never been. No third world country has a border like that. And no third, I'll tell you what, no third world country has weaponization where they go after political candidates like we have either.
Associated Press polling in March showed shifting voter attitudes on immigration, with nearly a third of Americans now saying it is a major risk that immigrants will commit crimes. That's up from 19% who thought that in 2017. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
The Israeli-Hamas war protests have led to rising conflict between police and the press throughout the United States. Both police and reporters go to protest with jobs to do, but journalists say police often prevent them from doing theirs. Robin Guess reports.
As police across the United States shut down protests over the Israel-Hamas war, journalists say they are also being targeted.
Are you filming this, right, Genevieve?
Yep. Yes.
Here, four officers detain and handcuff columnist Robin Epley of California's Sacramento Bee, covering protesters during a recent city council meeting.
This one in particular, though, is so egregious because the people who were doing this to me are the people who are supposed to keep us safe. The police department is supposed to uphold the law. And in reality, what they were doing was breaking it.
Sacramento police, in an email, blamed Epley for not wearing a newly created city press credential. But Epley and others say police violated a 2021 California law that specifically protects journalists covering protests. California State Senator Mike McGuire wrote the law in response to the protests over the 2020 police murder of unarmed African-American George Floyd. McGuire says at that time, police assaulted and arrested the press for doing their jobs.
And in many cases, journalists put their own lives on the line to be able to bring all of us at home the story. And so what we know is that SB 98, it provide some of the strongest press protections in all of America.
Conflicts between police and journalists during George Floyd protests led to police policy changes in Minnesota, Los Angeles, New York, and elsewhere. But the problem persists, according to the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. The group's data show police arrested or detained 36 journalists covering Israel-Hamas demonstrations since October. Here's journalist John Farina with online news organization Status Quo.
What is at stake here is our constitutional rights, our human rights. You know, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. There is no regard for that from law enforcement.
Farina shot this video of a journalist knocked down and then arrested by New York police. She's covering the May protests at Columbia University. He's captured other instances of New York police assaulting reporters. The New York Police Department hasn't responded to VOA's emailed and phone requests for comment. NYPD recently paid $10 million to settle a 2021 lawsuit brought by journalists and protesters who say police assaulted and arrested them without cause during 2020's George Floyd social justice protest.
That's all we worked very hard to present to you this Tuesday, June 11, 2024. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.